right. Well, next week, I'm going to get into a couple of weeks of some Christmas messages. So I don't want you to think I've forgotten that it's Christmas. As soon as I walked in here and saw the beautiful decorations, I was reminded, yes, that's right, it's Christmas. So, but that's my plan all along. But today, I'd like to take you to that little epistle of 3 John. 3 John. And, I didn't want to go there. It's already there. And talk a little bit about character that destroys or builds or destroys a church. Now, just so you understand, I'm not preaching that because I think there's some people in here that are destructive. Don't get that wrong message at all. There are just certain things we all need to be aware of in any church. Now, I know I got a creepy guy there lurking in the shadows. That actually was head elder at the first church I pastored, but and didn't last long. Now, I don't know where that came from, but I thought, well, I put a creepy guy up there, that'll get your attention at least. But, you know, I think you would probably all agree that not just in church, but in any organization, there are all kinds of people, all kinds of characters. You know, we all have our own idiosyncrasies, our peculiarities. There are people anywhere that are interesting, pleasant. I fortunately have met more pleasant people in my life than I have annoying people or odd people or weird. But, you know, weird people do find their way into churches sometimes, but not just churches. But, you know, like I say, I don't want to accuse anybody here of being weird or odd or peculiar. But if you are, God still loves you and Jesus died for you. And we love you too. So, but beyond all that, if we turn to 3 John, this is a very short personal letter. In fact, Chuck Swindoll calls it a postcard. He wrote a little book about the epistles of John. And it's very straight shooting message from the Apostle John, written to one of his friends. And he actually, as you'll see here, he talks about three different individuals. And two of them are good people. They were his friends. And one was not a friend at all. He was an enemy. And we'll see what we can learn from these individuals. But the first character we meet is the man to whom this letter is addressed. His name is Gaius, or Gaius, however you prefer to pronounce that. But John describes him in these first 8 verses. So if you let me just read these for you. I'm reading from the ESV this morning, so I hope that's okay. The elder, and that's John referring to himself as the elder, to the beloved Gaius, whom I love in truth. Beloved, I pray that all may go well with you and that you may be in good health as it goes well with your soul. For I rejoiced greatly when the brothers came and testified to your truth, as indeed you are walking in the truth. I have no greater joy than to hear that my children are walking in the truth. Beloved, it is a faithful thing you do in all your efforts, for these brothers, strangers as they are, who testify to your love before the church, you will do well to send them on their journey in a manner worthy of God, for they have gone out for the sake of the name, accepting nothing from the Gentiles. Therefore, we ought to support people like these, that we may be fellow workers for the truth. Now, we'll describe what some of that is talking about in just a moment. But there are several men in the New Testament that went by the name of Gaius. So I really don't know who this particular individual is, other than the fact that the way John writes, this Gaius seems to have occupied a position of leadership within the church. And maybe he was the pastor, maybe an elder, maybe a deacon, we don't know. But he was one who was a very godly man. And John knew him on a personal level. And he indicates that perhaps Gaius may have come to Christ under John's ministry. Because when John says in verse 4 that I have no greater joy than to hear that my children are walking in the truth, John's children, well, we would look at that as most likely referring to children in the faith, people who came to Christ under his ministry or who were discipled under his ministry. Remember, the Apostle Paul referred to Timothy as my son. Well, he wasn't his biological son, but he referred to him as my son in the faith. And so when John hears word that people who were influenced to Christ by his ministry, it certainly is an encouraging thing. And if you've been in that position, you know what that is like. But when we talk about the truth that he says here, you're walking in the truth just consists of that entire body of doctrine that was delivered by the apostles to the churches. All the scriptures explain concerning God's commandments, everything concerning Christ and the Gospels. So when we walk in the truth, we're walking according to God's Word. We're living the Word. So Gaius was committed to not only living the truth, but he also obviously was teaching the truth. And John says several things about Gaius here that are worth imitating. So we're going to dwell on these characteristics of these individuals as we move along here. The first thing you notice in verse 2 is that Gaius was spiritually healthy. He was spiritually healthy. Now, John seems to be praying that Gaius's physical health will be as good as his spiritual health. Now, I don't know if John is suggesting to us here that Gaius may have had some physical problems, but he certainly was very, very healthy spiritually. But, you know, it also would indicate to us that a person could be very healthy physically, but very unhealthy spiritually. But the whole point is, Gaius was a great model of spiritual health and maturity, and thereby earned the love and respect not only of John, but of the church, because the reports came back to John from people who had been at that church, and I'll describe those people in a moment. But they came back reports of how Gaius was such a godly man and such a spiritual leader. Well, not only that, we learn that he maintained a good testimony in verses 3 and 4. John had heard from these others who had been in the church and bringing back their reports that he had a consistent walk with Christ. And he was indeed a model for them to pattern their own lives after. So when I read something like that, it makes me want to ask the question of myself, and maybe we all should ask this question, what is my reputation? What is my reputation in the church as well as outside the church? What testimony would others give if they were asked about our character? Very often I'm asked to be a reference for individuals, people who are either applying for a job or most often if they're applying for a position at a Christian camp or applying for to a Christian college or some mission activity and they need a pastor's recommendation. I'm always happy to do that, but I hope they understand that I am obligated to be honest in my evaluations of them. I'm not going to lie for them and give them a glowing report if they're not. I'm not going to give them a 10 on something if they're really a 7 or a 6 or worse. I'm not trying to harm them or make sure they don't get accepted. Yeah, I hope they do, but I don't want to say all these glowing things about this person, and then when they do get hired or accepted, then those who are in charge find out that this person's not at all like I described. I want to be honest and I want to be accurate to the best of my knowledge. And sometimes, you know, when they ask a question, how is this person's testimony outside the church, I have to say, I don't know, because I've never observed them in that context before. So, you know, they might be a flat-out hypocrite, I don't know. But, you know, we want to be honest about that. So we have to ask ourselves, you know, what kind of a testimony am I leaving to the people that meet me or come across my path? I used to be called upon quite frequently to do funerals for people that were unchurched. There's a few funeral homes back in town that would call me. Those were always a bit of a challenge to do because I didn't know the person, for one thing, and knowing that they were not church people. My conclusion is probably they weren't Christians, but they wanted a preacher to do their funeral. So I refer to myself as a rent-a-preacher in that regard. But what I would do is I would meet with a family and see what I could find out about this individual, and, you know, so I could put together some kind of a eulogy. It's hard to eulogize a person you don't know, but they would tell me, you know, all about their relative there, and I would be able to put some stories together or some things. And I always hoped that a family member would give a eulogy because it's more personal and more accurate. But I remember one particular time I met with the family, and they told me all these things about Grandpa and Dad, and he sounded like a great guy. So I put together a eulogy and said all these nice things about him. And at the end of the service, one of the individuals, a man who was in attendance, came up to me and he said, "I don't know who you were talking about up there, but it wasn't him." I'm sorry, I just going by what I was told. I never met him. But I remember one particular time, too, I had to do a funeral for a man who had passed away. He had one daughter, and that was all. So I went to the funeral home and met with her. We went over and sat down on the couch, and the first thing she said was, "I just want you to know, if you're planning to say anything good about my dad, don't bother, because there's nothing good to say about him." And I thought, okay. It's going to be a short service, I think. But in those cases, I always try to share the gospel. But I had to share the gospel without necessarily saying that this person is in heaven, because I didn't know. But there was a fine line I had to walk. But here's a guy like Gaius, who everybody who crossed his path and met him came back with this great report. And that's what we ought to strive for. And hope that when our time comes to leave this earth, the eulogies will be accurate. Not that we want people to brag about us, but I hope I have a couple of mourners at my funeral. You know, I told my daughters, you know, if you have to hire some mourners, do it, you know. But he maintained a good testimony. Third, he was hospitable. Now, this is where we get into what John was talking about in verses 5 through 7. This was a very important service in that day for fellow believers. Because for the gospel to spread and for churches to be ministered to as well as they could be, they were dependent upon itinerant teachers, preachers, missionaries who would come into those towns. They would help with evangelism. They would minister in the churches and teach doctrine of the apostles, because not all the churches had pastors. They would have elders, but it was always good to have these teachers that would come into town. But when they did, they needed a place to stay. And the inns were not the best places for people to stay in those days. They were seedy at best. Many of them were more like brothels. They just were not good places for good people to attend. Now, there are some motels that we know, you know, that are not the best places you want to stay either. I know a few of them over in Kalamazoo that I would never put a guest up in that hotel or that motel, because somebody's probably cooking meth in the room next door, or they probably cooked it in the room, the people that previously slept there, and all kinds of things that go on. But they were really bad in these early days of the church. So because of that, these itinerant teachers and missionaries would depend upon individuals in the church to take them into their homes. Now, they're called strangers, is the term John used here, because they were strangers to these people. But many of these individuals would carry with them letters of recommendation from their home church, so they could show them those letters, and the people would know that, okay, these are their credentials. We can trust these individuals and take them into our home. Now, even today, we have to be careful who we let into our homes, don't we? Because there are people out there that intend to do us harm. That's why you got to be real careful about anybody comes to your door posing as a utility worker, because he could be an imposter who just wants to get into your home and check it out so he can break in later or to do harm to you. And that's why we have the real utility workers today now. You know, the company tells you, The worker will be there at this particular time. He will have an ID. His name is so-and-so. So you know that when he comes, he's got the badge and everything. So anyway, they had to house these individuals. So Gaius was very good at that, as John commends him for. You've taken in these strangers into your home. But then he urges Gaius in verse 6, you do well to send them on their journey in a manner worthy of God. In other words, do even more for them. Go the extra mile. Now, how would that look? Well, maybe he was suggesting that Gaius fill their bag with some extra food for their journey, or maybe give them some money to help them with their needs. So he is a good example in that respect. Now, verse 8 then is more of a kind of an exhortation to us. But John is including himself. And the suggestion here is that we should be equally as generous. We should be equally as generous. So when John says we, like I said, he's including himself. We all should be equally as generous. Because we know that many missionaries have sacrificed much to serve the Lord. And therefore, we ought to support them because we're all fellow workers in the gospel, regardless of where we are or what our position is. Not everyone is called to be a foreign missionary or to be a pastor or to be in some sort of career ministry. But the church in that respect is sort of like an army. Not so much in the militant aspect of it, but in the sense that some soldiers are sent to the front lines. They're sent into the difficult places. Others are assigned to the supply lines who keep the food, the supplies, the ammunition, so to speak, going to those who need it. So there are some people who are called by God to leave their homes and their families to go and take the gospel somewhere else, but others are called to stay back and write the checks and pray and open their homes to them when they come home for their furlough ministries. So when we think of Gaius, the bottom line here is if you want a good character to emulate, Gaius is your guy, a good goal to strive for. But now in verse 9, John's tone changes quite dramatically as he introduces us to a second character that is not a model to follow. I call him Diotrephes the Dragon. Diotrephes the Dragon. The reason I call him a dragon is that years ago, a pastor friend of mine gave me a book to read. The title was Well-Intentioned Dragons. And it was a book for pastors on how to deal with difficult members in their church who maybe they mean well, but they can be very destructive. Now, I don't think there are any dragons here in your church here, so I'm not trying to suggest anything, but they do show up. They are in churches, and I've dealt with individuals like that. Maybe in their minds, yeah, their intentions were right or good. They thought they were doing right, but what they were doing was very destructive. So I call him Diotrephes the Dragon. Now we pick him up at verse 9. I'll just read verses 9 and 10. I have written something to the church, but Diotrephes, who likes to put himself first, does not acknowledge our authority. So if I come, I will bring up what he is doing, talking wicked nonsense against us. And not content with that, he refuses to welcome the brothers. And also stops those who want to and puts them out of the church. Now, this guy's a real character. Now, he obviously was some sort of leader or influential man in the church. We don't know really that much about him, but we do know he was the polar opposite of Gaius. And he was a problem. Influential. A while back, several years ago, I read a book. I think Leith Anderson was the author of it. But part of the book, he described a study that he had done. I don't know if he was working on a doctorate degree or whatever. But he had contacted churches all over the country to obtain copies of their organizational flowchart, Now, most every organization has it, and most churches have one too. I don't know if you do or not, but you know, it's the starts out usually. It's the head is God or Jesus Christ, as it should be, and then right below Jesus is either the pastor or, in some cases, they have the elders and the deacons, and then the below them is the pastor, and so he's accountable to them. Every church does it a little different, but it all works its way down. Then you have the committee people and chairman and chairwomen and the all the members of those committees and the different ministries, and it just kind of spreads its way out. Every church has their own. But he said there was one particular one that was kind of took him back, and he had a picture of it in the book. It was all it was a sheet of paper, had a big circle. And then inside the circle, it was just full of dots. And then right in the middle of all those dots was the name Ralph. Now, you kind of get the idea right away how that organizational flow chart worked. Ralph, whoever he was, he wasn't the pastor, because it didn't say Pastor Ralph or pastor. It just said Ralph. And the pastor's probably the one who put that flow chart together. But it was quite obvious that the dots represented the congregation and everything revolved around Ralph, whoever he was. But obviously, he was the person that everything went through. If Ralph agreed with it, we did it. If Ralph didn't agree with it, we didn't do it. And maybe Ralph was a guy that had the money. And sometimes that happens. You get in these smaller rural churches, the guy who's the money bags controls everything. And I mentioned the first church I was at that kind of operated that way. There was one guy who was the money man. And I remember one time he told me, money talks. And, you know, so whatever was done, they made sure he approved of it. In fact, I'll share this with you. I shouldn't, but I had some problems there. I was not a good fit for that church. It was a rural church that just was a renegade bunch of people. There were some wonderful people there, some very pleasant people that loved us dearly, but there were a few that just were well-intentioned dragons, and they wanted me out. And I remember this guy came into my office one time and sat down across my desk, and he offered to pay me 3 months' salary out of his own pocket if I would leave now. And being young and, you know, a little cocky, I said, you know, I appreciate that, but you keep your money, I'll leave when God tells me to leave. Looking back, I wish I'd have taken his money and stayed. But, you know, the Lord was good. It wasn't long after that I got contacted by somebody, and it opened up the opportunity to go to the church that I'd spent the last 32 years at, and I had a great ministry there. But you got to watch out for the Ralphs in your church. Now, if your name is Ralph, I apologize. It was just that was in the book. But what was this guy guilty of? What made this man tick, this guy Diotrephes? Well, he was guilty of selfish ambition. Selfish ambition is very clear, the first part of verse 9. And, you know, selfish ambition and self-promotion, they lie at the root of so many problems, whether it's a church or any other organization. You might work with people who, they're looking out for number one, and they've got the ambition, and they walk all over people, and they don't care who they knock over or step on when they're climbing the ladder of success. But John knew from personal experience that these people exist. I think he probably remembered the time when Jesus was rebuking the Pharisees, which he did quite often. Talk about well-intentioned dragons. The scribes and the Pharisees and the Sadducees were just exactly that. But one time in Matthew 23, at verse 11, Jesus was in a confrontation with those guys, and this is what he said: "The greatest among you shall be your servant. Whoever exalts himself will be humbled. Whoever humbles himself will be exalted." Trouble is, they didn't get it, but he spoke the truth to them. Now, we'll come back to that in just a moment. But just remember that large egos and bad attitudes wreak havoc in a church or any organization for that matter. And a church's future is in jeopardy when a Diotrephes gets into a position of leadership or influence. Well, what do we know about this guy? Selfish ambition. He also had disrespect for authority. Again, in verse 9, John says that he had previously written a letter to the church. Now, he's not referring to 2 John, the one that precedes this one. There's obviously another letter that John had written to the church, but somehow Diotrephes had intercepted that letter and refused to acknowledge John's authority by ignoring the letter. He probably destroyed it, and Gaius never saw it. That's why John says, I wrote a letter, but you didn't see it. Gaius got a hold of it. But whatever happened, the effect was to reject the instructions that were coming from the Apostle John. And this probably is why this letter here of 3 John was sent directly to Gaius rather than addressed to the church where Diotrephes could get his filthy hands on it. Well, can you imagine the gall of a guy like Diotrephes to openly reject the authority of an apostle of Jesus Christ? That's what staggers me. And the only explanation I can think of is that maybe he may have been jealous of John's authority. Or maybe in his arrogance, he thought that he was more important than John. Well, one source I read said that the name Diotrephes was uncommon back in that day. That it actually was found only among wealthy families. Which would suggest to me that maybe the social prestige or the wealth that Diotrephes had may have been at the root of his behavior, and maybe that was the reason he was appointed to a position of leadership or influence in the church. It's always risky to do that. But the good lesson for any church is never place a person in a position of leadership just because they are wealthy or influential or have status in a community. But boy, that's tempting. And I know from personal experience, it's nice to say, you know, we have Dr. So-and-so as a member of our church. Oh, the CEO of the big corporation, yeah, he comes to our church. And he's on our board or whatever. Now, I'm not suggesting that people who are wealthy and influential of status are negative or bad. No, there are some wonderful Christian people who are in positions of leadership in corporations and businesses and have great status and have great wealth, and they're doing wonderful things for the church and for the whole ministry of Christ, and they're using their influence in proper ways and good ways. I'm thankful to have them around. There are some, though, that we just have to be careful about, and I'm just suggesting that a church should never just place a person in leadership on the basis of another person's status or wealth or prestige. In fact, I've told my church many times through the years, when it comes to social status or wealth or prestige or your job or whatever else you have, we check it all at the door when we come into the church. Because when we come into the church, we're all equal. We're all on the same plane. God sees us all in the same way, and he doesn't measure us according to our status in life. The janitor working the third shift is just as important as the CEO up in the head office. Well, two others. Malicious gossip. Now, John says that he was accusing us with wicked nonsense or with wicked words. It just means he was saying things that were malignant and false about John and the other apostles. But you know, the thing about gossip is that it doesn't have to be a flat-out lie. Gossip can include half-truths, exaggerations of the truth, innuendo, anything that is intended to discredit a person or to raise doubt about their character. That's why I hate politics so much. Today we have to deal with fake news, don't we? You got to be real careful on social media, because I've learned that when you see a headline, I've some inflammatory headline about some person. So I'll click on to read the article, and it's got nothing to do at all about what the headline said. Well, the headline was just meant as an attention grabber, and they know that some people never get past the headline. As long as they see a headline that's something inflammatory about somebody else, they believe it. They don't check it out. But we have to make sure that the reports we hear are verified with reliable sources. Now, why did this man treat the Apostle John so viciously? Well, as I mentioned a moment ago, it may have been jealousy. He was jealous of John's authority. And that's a bad thing, because if jealousy or envy goes unchecked, it turns into bitter resentment. The late actress Carrie Fisher, who I don't believe was a Christian, but who knows, but she made an accurate statement. She said, resentment is like drinking poison and waiting for the other person to die. It just doesn't work that way. Resentment, we know, is what caused Cain to kill Abel. It's what caused Saul to become an enemy of David. So if you're harboring any kind of resentment toward another person, confess it to God and let him wash that poison from your heart before it destroys you. But also I would say that if you are a victim of someone else's malicious words or gossip, or even attacks they've made toward you, don't retaliate with venomous words of your own. Don't get back at them, because all that does is escalate the tension and pours gasoline on an already smoldering fire. I've seen that happen time and again. And I've always cautioned people, if you get an email from somebody that is accusing you of something or they're all wrong, don't shoot an email back to them right away, because you're angry. And you're going to say things that are regretful. Just let it lay for a day or two till you calm down. And maybe you don't have to answer it. I received some great advice from Alistair Begg when he spoke at one of the pastor's conferences at Moody Bible Institute that I was attending. And he dealt with this very subject. And he suggested to us that if you become a victim of somebody's attack, just answer with this Bible reference. It's from Nehemiah chapter 6, verse 8. Just jot that down, Nehemiah 6, 8. You don't have to turn there. But this is when Nehemiah was under attack by Sanballat and Tobiah, and they were trying to destroy him and stop the work of building the walls. So they were accusing him of all kinds of things. So if somebody accuses you of something that's false, just write back or answer them Nehemiah 6, 8, because this is what it says. No such things as you say have been done, for you are inventing them in your own mind. So that's a good way to answer. Let them look it up and they can read it. Well, Diotrephes was not content with disrespect, self-promotion, campaign of gossip. He also had an unwelcoming spirit. Verse 10, he refused to welcome those outsiders, those itinerant teachers who came along. Apparently resented their arrival. And maybe he feared that if the church heard another teacher, then maybe his own position might be threatened. Now, I'm just speculating here. I don't have any proof of this, but this is, I think this through, maybe this was it. Maybe he just felt threatened. That if they hear this other teacher, well, he might be contradicting what I'm trying to tell people, or he might be a threat to my position. That can work both ways, too, but I had to deal for a short time with some carnality in my own life. There was a time when I'd have another speaker come into my church, a guest speaker, representing something, and they were really good. And I'd be sitting down there listening, thinking, oh, the people are never going to want me. They're not going to listen to me again. This guy's so good. I can't match that. But then it'd work the other way. I'd have a speaker in, and he would be just abominable, and I'd think, they're going to be glad when I get back up here. So, that was sinful, just carnal. Thankfully, the Lord forgave me of that, and I got over it, and I realized that, you know, there is a benefit to the church from anybody that can come in and speak the word of God, whether they're doing a great job or they're stumbling over every word. Because I've had speakers in my church that I thought, boy, that guy needs to polish that up. Then afterwards, people tell me, that guy touched my heart. He was so good. I would think, I don't know what you heard, but I didn't hear that. But no, I didn't do that. But, you know, Diotrephes, regardless of the benefit to the church of hearing these other teachers come into the congregation, he was determined to protect his own position at all cost, evidently. More concerned about the glory of his own name than the name of Christ. Now, one final flaw in this man's character. A lot to say about this guy, but I think John knew that this guy could be destructive and was being destructive, and that was the abuse of his own authority. Not only did he refuse to let these itinerant teachers and missionaries into his home, and he didn't want them in the church either, and he wouldn't lift a finger to help anyone who tried to assist these teachers, the verse tells us here that anybody who did welcome them, he had them kicked out of the church. Now, where did a guy get that kind of influence or power? I don't know, but apparently he did. But his actions were downright disgraceful. But we know that there are even pastors who are abusive of their own authority, abusive to their congregations. Maybe you've encountered one in your past. I hope not, and I hope you never do. But I've heard of some, and I've known some. Well, I'm going to come back to verse 11, but I want to get to the third character, and there's not a whole lot said about him here. In verse 12, it's Demetrius, and I call him Demetrius the Example. Verse 12 says, Demetrius has received a good testimony from everyone and from the truth itself, and we add our testimony, and you know that our testimony is true. This wonderful Christian man only gets one verse. Diotrephes gets a whole paragraph. Demetrius gets eight verses, or Gaius rather, gets eight verses. Demetrius only gets one. And maybe John was running out of room on that postcard. But still, what he does say about Demetrius in this one little verse here tells us everything we know about and need to know about his godly example and his Christian testimony. And I think it's encouraging to know that we may not all reach the level of Gaius, but we can all be like Demetrius. And two things that John says about him is that he received a good testimony. He was well spoken of by everyone. Everyone in the church, that is. Jesus said in Luke 6:26, "Woe to you if all men speak well of you." That means there are enemies of Christ, and if the enemies of Christ are speaking well of you, you might not be doing something right here. But Demetrius was good, and he was walking according to God's truth, and he received this good report from the faithful believers in the church. And secondly, he embodied the truth, meaning he lived it. He took his faith in the Word of God seriously, and John added his own affirmation. We add our testimony, and you know our testimony's true. In other words, we don't say anything about anybody unless it's actually true. You can trust us. So here are just two questions to ponder. I don't have these in the notes. But first of all, who do you imitate? Whether we know it or not, we all have our heroes, people that we like to emulate. Is this person godly? Is it someone we should want to be like or someone we should actually avoid? And secondly, who are the people you surround yourself with? Who are your friends, your colleagues, your peeps, if you want to put it that way? What's the group you want to be a part of? Will this group make you better or pull you down? You see, we have a calling from God. And John learned this personally from Jesus. Remember the time when he and his brother James were walking with Jesus and they asked him if he would grant to them seats of honor when they get into glory, next to Jesus himself. Now, why they thought they were deserving of those positions over anybody else, I don't know. But, you know, they were young in the faith yet. But Jesus answered them with words that are good for us to know. This is what he said in Mark chapter 10 at verse 43. Well, I'll back it up here a little bit. You know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be your slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many, which is what we acknowledged during the communion service. But you know, the term leader in the Bible is seldom used. In fact, in the King James Version, the word leader only appears 6 times. Much more often, the word servant is used in reference to those who would do his work. Moses, my servant. The apostles describe themselves as servants of Jesus Christ, bond slaves of Jesus Christ. Servant's not a typical role we like to assume because it conjures up images of low prestige, low respect, low honor. But whenever Jesus used the term servant, it was synonymous with greatness. Whoever wishes to be great among you must be your servant. Paul wrote in Galatians 5:13, serve one another in love. Servant leader is the title assigned to those who would do the work of God. And so if God has called you to be a leader, head of a committee, head of something, chairman of this or that, do it. But make sure you do it with humility and with a servant's heart. And seek to bring glory to God, not to yourself. And if you can do that, that will make the disappointments and the failures easier to handle. And it will make the successes become greater in their perspective. So I trust you'll continue on, be those like Gaius or Demetrius, and have a good report within your community, a shining example of Christian people who love Jesus and who love one another. Well, I apologize for going over time a bit here. I'll make up for that next week. Okay. Father, thank you for your word to us once again and for your love for us, your patience with us. We recognize that we fail you so often, and our carnality gets in the way so often, and we have to learn from our mistakes and our errors, but how thankful we are that you are such a forgiving God, so patient. Your love never ends. Even in our failures, it's not going to be the end. That you take us back, dust us off, and move us on. Help us to go forth from this place with a greater sense of humility and being your servants as we serve one another. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.